Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Boston has seen a lot of changes over the past few decades, one of the most notable being the Big Dig, an infrastructure project that changed the landscape and the character of the city forever. By the time the nearly 16 years of construction resulting from the Big Dig ended in 2007, Boston was left with new landmarks like the Ted Williams Tunnel and Zakim Bridge. It also had new challenges to face, like gentrification and a changing identity that made some feel like it was no longer the city they once knew and loved. Adam Abramowitz is familiar with that. He grew up in Alston and the South End between the 70s and early 2000s and graduated from UMass Boston in 1988. Now he's documented his experiences with a changing Boston in a new novel called A Town Called Malice, which is a sequel to his novel Boss Town. These days, Adam lives and teaches in New York, but he always makes his way back home, and he's joining me here in Boston in the studio. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the Boston you knew when you were growing up and what it was like back then and how that plays a role in your new novel.
Yeah, Boston was a great town, a great city to live in. And it was really, I describe it as kind of a rock and roll city. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a thriving music scene and club scene in Boston. There was also a lot of separation, segregation, balkanization, whatever you want to call it, of neighborhoods. And that led to a lot of conflict between people. And you kind of had to know where you were and who you were with at the time. So it was thrillingly dangerous, but an exciting place to be.
And in A Town Called Malice, in your book, one of the main characters is, of course, Zesty Myers, who's a bike messenger and is the main character. But another character is the Big Dig, and it's used as a time marker in a story and reflects how it's changed a lot of the lives of a lot of people, including, in this case, Zesty. He was a bike messenger, so it affected his business, his ability to pay rent. It's affected other Bostonians in real life in that way. Talk a little bit about how the Big Dig affected different Bostonians.
Absolutely. It changed a lot of neighborhoods, and it changed the city in an interesting way. The way that I think about it is Boston used to really tolerate screw-ups or people who took longer to cultivate whatever it was that they were pursuing. You were able to, you know, rent an apartment and have a lousy job or find a loft space and do your artwork. So it really was a place, I used to call it a starter city. It was a great place to start out. The Big Dig brought about change. It seems that it's forced communities to kind of reckon with rising rents. Some people, you know, figured out that the city was changing and kind of adapted to it. Other people like Zesty, like my main character, modeled after me for better or worse, wasn't a real estate whisperer. He realized change was happening but couldn't necessarily go with the flow.
And this is a crime novel, but talk a little bit more about the autobiographical nature of Zesty Myers.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I never had a real job in Boston. I worked for Nick's Cheap and Friendly Moving Company, which still exists. I worked as a messenger. I scooped ice cream. So there was a lot. It took a lot of work to stay there, but the city was welcoming. I mean, The Big Dig and the crimes of the novel are based on Boston stories. So Zesty's mother was politically active and disappeared after a bank robbery. She's modeled after, you know, Catherine Power, the Brandeis, you know, bank robbery in Alston. Zesty's father has a series of poker games that he runs in Boston clubs after closing. And he's modeled after a bunch of underground poker clubs that I used to attend in the city. So a lot of this exists, but I don't know where they've gone at this point.
So you mentioned Boston being what you called a rock and roll town. Talk about the soundtrack of the city and how it's changed and the role that plays in the book.
So Zesty, in the first book, Zesty gets hit by a car and it triggers something in his brain, a traumatic brain injury, that he has a playlist in his head, and it's all local Boston rock and roll. I'm really indebted to a number of bands, the Neighborhoods, Robin Lane, the Chartbusters, the Atlantics. These are bands that really inspired me growing up. And to have that music as kind of an ongoing soundtrack in Zesty's head, I think we all have some kind of a soundtrack that we identify with our a certain time and a certain place. And certainly Boston was a town where you could look at local music and really tie it into where you were, what you were doing, who you were with, where you lived, and what was going on in your life.
Now, you talk about old Boston. I remember it, too. I came here as a student before the Big Dig and left right after it was completed in a very nostalgic way. But the Big Dig, in a lot of ways, amplified the haves and the have-nots. And you talk about that in your book and you know, made the city, for a lot of people, less affordable. It's exacerbated race differences. Talk about that a little bit. And did everybody in Boston experience the effects of the Big Dig the same way?
I think the Big Dig was inescapable. Whether, you know, you lived in a neighborhood that, you know, all your life and you had family history there, I think that the Big Dig, you know, the whole theory of rising tide lifts all boats doesn't really apply in this case, because a lot of people could point to the Big Dig as a turning point for the city where it really decided to become a first-class city. But a lot of us kind of live in leaky boats and half-finished boats. So it really separated people. I think it really brought to light the divide in this city, which was more financial than anything else. It used to be more based on, you know, ethnicity and color. But now it was really with, you know, a wash of money coming in. That's where the divide seemed to creep up. And Zesty certainly didn't keep up with it. And neither did I, unfortunately.
And the segregation in the city certainly preceded the Big Dig by a good amount. Did it go in the other direction? I mean, the Boston that you see today, after the Big Dig, do you see that it has helped change that in a positive way? And in addition to the ways that it helped exacerbate some sort of economic disparities?
Right. I can only kind of speak for the South End and Austin, really kind of my stomping grounds. And I see a lot of a lot of the same people that I'd seen before who weren't displaced, and I've talked to them, and they have said that the neighborhood has changed for the better in some ways. You know, it's greener. There's less vacant lots and things of that nature. But it has become increasingly competitive for space, for schooling, for everything that comes with, you know, whatever we want to call as progress. So I think that it depends on, you know, your status and how you're doing. But I think that it's helped some neighborhoods, but we have to always be mindful when change comes, it affects people differently.
So you, back in March, you wrote an essay for the literary culture website Crime Reads about how this genre of storytelling, you call it big city noir, is under siege. You talk about how readers can become just as attached to a city that serves as a setting for a crime thriller as they can to the characters, but that the gentrification of these places threaten to smooth them all out. What did you mean by that?
Well, I took a lot of heat for that. A lot of people wrote to me saying, what, you want crime to come back into our cities? You want garbage not to be picked up? But that wasn't my point. My point was that as the city changes, there's a certain flavor that I think disappears. There's a certain feeling that we can't all exist in the same spaces that were once affordable. So that big city noir, I think, does there's a little too much light shining into those dark alleys. Zesty, you know, to me is a different kind of noir. It's more like a slacker noir. So he navigates a wholly different city than what we see today in Boston.
And so for a lot of things that the Big Dig did, I mean, when I lived here, I lived in JP. Yeah. The Big Dig made it much easier to get to the airport. It eased congestion. You have beautification efforts like the Rose Kennedy Greenway. Were these good side effects of the Big Dig?
So easier to me doesn't necessarily mean better. There's something to be said for the struggle. And I like to think that in some ways, in many ways, we define ourselves with our struggle and from our struggle. There are certain conveniences that are afforded to us now. But the trade-off, I think, is pretty steep and affects us in ways that maybe we don't feel right now, but they're creeping up on us.
So just in a few seconds left, you don't live in Boston anymore, but you come back frequently. You said that you would live here if you could afford it. Is there anything else holding you back from coming back to the hub?
No. If Netflix is out there, I'd be more than happy to come back and live in the hub and get right back to my South End roots. But anytime Boston wants to welcome me back, I'd be happy to be here.
All right. Adam Abramowitz, author of A Town Called Malice. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Great song.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.